Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Breaking ball pulled down the line, a fair ball, it's by Napoli. Encarnacion scores. Here comes Ramirez into second base with a two-run double as Lonnie Chisenhall. And the Indians have taken command of the game with a three-run sixth. They lead it 5-1. Got him looking. Corey Kluber starts it off with his 94th strikeout of the year. Fastball inside corner, rung him up. That's that two-seamer. The 2-2. Got him looking. A dirty dozen for Corey Kluber.
Tremendous. You know, only thing he gave was an 0-2 breaking ball to a really good hitter. We've seen him before when he gets on a roll, and man, he seems like he's right there now, and it's good because, you know, he wanted to get to a point where he could pitch every 5 days. Giving him the ball is on a night when you're trying to stay away from Cody and Miller, and he does that. That's really big.
Driven toward the gap in left center field. That ball is hit well, and it is gone. A three-run shot for Justin Upton, and the Tigers jump out to a 3-0 lead.
Man, go to work.
Uh-oh. Hensler just launched one. It's out to the wall, and Gordon leaps. It's gone. Home run for Ian Kinsler. And he skies this one in the air to right field. That ball is hit well. It's going to the track, to the wall. It is gone. Romine pulling it into the seats in right, and the Tigers have their third home run of the day. Looks at strike three, and a good way to start this one for Fulmer. Just the 1-2. Got him, strike three.
Offense did their job, defense their job, did their job. Obviously, Alex did his. Just one out short, you know. So it happens. I felt like stuff was good all game, and then even that ninth inning, get two quick outs, and I wasn't trying to overdo anything. I felt like they fouled off some great pitches, and ultimately got some just found holes that one inning. I'm so happy with the way we got the win today, and just glad everybody got to contribute as well.
Chapkov is a tough opponent. You know, he's coming to fight. But as you see, I'm coming to, like I said, put my skills on the line to be the first to stop it. Just be me. If you ever see me fight, you've seen I always stay composed and stay fighting in my rhythm. Knocking him out. Just knocking him out. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is fight night in Toledo, Ohio. How about that? Welcome to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo's sports leader. Robert Easter Jr. tonight at Huntington Center. IBF Lightweight Championship on the line against Denis Shapovalov. And we are going to talk about it coming up in about an hour from now. Bronco McCart will join us to break it down. Bronco's a frequent guest when talking fighting on with Mike Miller and the Drive Time program, but he's been kind enough to join us today, or he will be at about 4 or 5 to preview that fight, the rest of the card at the Huntington Center tonight, and also, yeah, buddy, we're probably going to get his thoughts on a couple of other major fights coming up later on at the end of the summer and into the fall, talking, of course, about the battle between Canelo Alvarez and Triple G, Gennady Golovkin. That should be just a classic, and then there's the more kind of circusy type of fight, if you will, between Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor. We'll get his thoughts on all of that coming up in the 4 o'clock hour of the program. The first hour of the extravaganza today is going to be one we like to call a free-for-all, Free-for-All Friday right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. It means open lines. Anything you want to talk about is fair game. We got a lot of things that have been on the table the last few days. We've talked a lot of NBA. Free agency, of course, starts tonight at midnight. Well, technically 12:01, somebody's allowed to sign. We've seen over the last few years that kind of happens. At least offers are made right at that time to show prospective free agents how much in love clubs are with them. Names like Paul Millsap are available on the market tonight. We've talked about a ton of them, obviously. There's talk about trades, and we'll get into that a little bit. You know, some of the folks out at ESPN think that it is time to move Kevin Love out of Cleveland and bring in Paul George or Carmelo Anthony via trade. We can talk about that. So we got some NBA stuff to do. Baseball, we always love Tigers and Indian series. We like them a little bit more when both teams are good and both teams are fighting for the same thing, such as, I don't know, you know, maybe the first place in the division spot. The Indians are in it. The Tigers are far out of it at 7 back. Is this something that they can close in this series? It's a 4-gamer, is it not, Jim?
Yes, it is, because we got a doubleheader tomorrow.
4-game series, Indians and Tigers. Tigers do some damage here and maybe take 3 out of 4. They close that gap a little bit and maybe get a little bit of a different feel or look at things heading toward the All-Star break in about a week plus. Indians take 3 out of 4, and, well, it's sale time. There's no doubt about it. It's sale time. Time to start packaging up, or I should say putting out some of the expensive high-priced talent that they are just not going to be able to rebuild around and get some players packaged up for them. If they split 2-2, obviously nothing changes. The Indians have a 7-game lead over the Tigers, and everything is right where it is. So it'll be very interesting to see. We always like it, though. It's always good. The Tigers, good news for them. They don't have to face the Klubot, who is really in true Klubot or robot form, if you will. Corey Hans Kluber. Do you realize, Jim Cushlin, since he came back off of the DL, what his record is?
His record is 4-0, if I'm not mistaken.
You're correct, but that doesn't tell the story.
No, it doesn't. To me, one of the things that tells the story is since he came back, I think he's had 6 starts. All of this month, because June 1st was his first one back from the DL.
That's correct.
He has double-digit strikeouts in 4 in a row and 5 of the 6. The one he didn't get.
That's correct also.
8. That, to me, tells a lot. The dude is in robot form.
He is 4-0 since he came off the DL in 6 starts with an ERA of 1.26 and 64 strikeouts over 43 innings. His 4 straight double-digit strikeouts ties somebody by the name of Bob Feller. Maybe you heard of him. For the most in a row for the franchise. And Feller did it over 38-39, the last couple of starts, and then the first couple of those 2 seasons. Kluber's the first in franchise history to do it in the same season. He has just been mowing people down. And I talked to a couple of the Indians reporters about a week ago, Jim, and I said, if the All-Star game is tomorrow, who makes it? And clearly Jose Ramirez is on that. And then they said probably Carrasco. Well, with Carrasco getting knocked around his last start, you wonder if it is going to be an Indian starter, if it is the ace, because now his ERA is down to, what was it after last night, 3.01,
I think it was, 3.01 or 3.02 after yesterday's game.
And with those strikeout numbers that I just mentioned, my goodness, and the run that he's on, there's very little doubt that he should be an All-Star again.
Well, we're going to find
Carrasco
out.
Carrasco will have to right the ship a little bit, obviously, if this is going to work for him, and get a couple more starts that are as stellar as the previous. You know, probably 5 out of the previous 6 had been, but looks like they're probably going to get a position player and 1 starter in, and it looks like it very well could be and should be maybe Kluber.
Yeah, and we're going to find out the answers to all that here real soon, I think, in both cases over the weekend, because voting for the starters ended last night. And then you got the reserves, and those are picked by coaches and players and all that stuff. And since the All-Star game is on July 11th, so 12 days from now, I want to say there's like a show tomorrow night or something that announces a lot of this stuff. At least the minimum, the starters. I got to double check to make sure that it's the reserves and pitchers as well. But we'll be finding out who's going to be making it, not just from the Indians, but who's going to be the Tigers rep and all the rest.
Yeah, no doubt. It is going to be very interesting to see. And I think that they deserve at least 2. And depending on how they do this 4-game series against the Tigers and then early next week, they might even deserve a 3rd All-Star on that team. Obviously, the Astros are going to load it up. Astros are going to have a ton of All-Stars when those are announced, and they deserve it. They've just got a great lineup. They're hitting from top to bottom. They got good rotation. They're the most complete team in the American League. They might be the most complete team in baseball.
Yeah.
So you can't expect, you know, the Indians that morning, but I think they may very well deserve 2, or excuse me, 3 by the time this is all said and done. So here's what we've got today, or tonight, I should say. It's Josh Tomlin, so this is good news for the Tigers. Tomlin is 4-9 with a 6.09, and Anibal Sanchez is going for the Tigers. That's not such good news for the Tigers. That's good news for the Indians. A couple of guys with 6-plus ERAs. Well, you understand, it could very well be one of those high-scoring games. Tomorrow, It's Carrasco and Matthew Boyd, followed by Jordan Zimmerman for the Tigers, and the Indians have not yet named a starter for that second game, I don't believe.
No, I have not seen anything official. I'm hearing grumblings that ALCS Game 5 hero Ryan Merritt might get called up because it's a doubleheader. So nowadays, as you know, the teams have that 26 roster spot for doubleheaders usually used to call up the starter and then send him right back down. You mentioned Matt Boyd, so we already know what the Tigers are going to do for their 26th spot. It's going to be Matt Boyd. But yeah, no official announcement on the Indians. But I'm hearing they're leaning towards Ryan Merritt for that one.
Sunday will be Mike Clevinger coming off of an outstanding outing. He's got a very nice little season going into the ERA right now at 3.56. Taking on Justin Verlander, that we spent a lot of time talking about yesterday, as maybe being a future former Tiger with the trade period really coming into play before the end of the month of July.
Absolutely.
So Verlander's 5-4 with a 4.47. What's that?
Absolutely. And then you mentioned it, you know, Clevinger, he was a tough luck loser a couple of days ago when he struck out a career high 9 and
Cody Allen gave it up.
Yeah, and filling in for Mike, I was kind of going yesterday on Drive Time, I kind of was going through some of the Indians things on the grounds of, you know, a lot of the subject for the next month when you're talking about baseball and the trade deadline is understandably in these parts going to be on what the Tigers may do. But I started to dive into what, if anything, would the Indians do, and part of my analysis, I was looking at it, if the playoffs started tomorrow, Clevinger would be my number four over Tomlin.
I would agree. I would agree. Based on performance, even though Tomlin really had a, you know, a nice run late last year and into the postseason, he did some really, really great yeoman's work, despite, remember, the very serious family situations he was dealing with his father and all that. He did great. So the experience factor might weigh into a Terry Francona decision in a situation like that if we were going to the playoffs. But for performance purposes, absolutely, you would certainly look at Clevinger. The other thing for bad news for the Tigers is we just kind of give a little quick preview of this, is that the games are at Comerica. Sorry about that. Not such a good thing because the Indians are a much, much better road team, as we have discussed, than they are a home team. That 3-4 homestand the Indians just completed dropped them overall to 18-21 in their own building. But on the road, they're a robust 24-15. So they're going to go in a really, really comfortable position to Comerica tonight for the first of that four games.
Yeah, just because of that home-road dynamic that we were talking about. The flip side for the Tigers is the series next weekend, same two teams will be in Cleveland.
Yeah, exactly right. So although by that time, again, decisions may have been made about some about some roster
situation. Do you think they should do that sooner rather than later, or should the Tigers hold out until towards more closer to the deadline?
I mean, I'm not saying they're going to make a deal on July 3rd.
Right, but should they wait until like the proverbial
I'm
last
minute?
I'm
looking at the tea leaves. I make the best deal when the right deal is available. I don't wait until
Good
the
answer.
Tail end if I'm the Tigers, because it's not going to happen. I mean, I'm ready to say, looking at, you know, the American League in general, not just the Central, but looking at the American League in general, I'm looking at this and saying, this is not a contender for an American League pennant. Even if they somehow squeeze their way into a second wild card situation, which is even doubtful at this stage, this isn't a team that's going to be contending. So if you're not going to contend, why put off the rebuild? Why put off the sale of those very expensive pieces and parts that we talk about, some of the high-profile, high-price-tag guys, like Verlander, like J.D., perhaps. Victor's not really movable.
Ian Kinsler, maybe.
Being a DH. Upton. You know, and we've gone through all of the guys. If the right deal becomes available in early July, Jim, and you really like the packages of prospects you can pull in, then do it. Don't wait until, let's see if we can get something better until late July, because then the opportunity may slip by. They cannot just leave this season with this roster largely intact and go into another offseason, on paper, this guy has had, you know, on paper, there's a lot of guys who have had great careers and great production, et cetera, but this season on the field, it just does not work. And whether that's an Osmus thing or it's a them thing, Lord only knows, but it's not going to work. Houston, Boston, the Yankees, the Indians, probably the Angels, maybe, as a potential wild card.
Rays, Twins,
did I say Yankees? Yeah, Yankees, yeah. Twins, which, again, I'm not still confident that they're going to be there, but they're there now. They're all better. They're all better. And even if they somehow manage to say, hey, we're a contender into late July, and when I say contender, I mean contender for a second wild card spot. You know, it's going to fall apart in August and September, and if it doesn't, you're going to go out in the first round or in the wild card game, period. That's it. And then you're stuck with all these pieces.
Or in a different way, it's not so much, you know, where these things are, because if you want to get truly technical, the worst team in the American League right now is the White Sox. They're 6.5 out of the second wild card. The problem really is for the Tigers is right now they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8 teams they have to climb over just to get to the second spot.
That's what I'm saying. So, you know, it's not going to happen, except that it's not going to happen. And simply, you know, make the right deal when the right deal is available. Don't wait until late, you know. But if, I mean, if you, I'm not saying sell, you know, in a bad way.
Right.
Early on, too. If somebody just gives you the thing that isn't right and you feel like you can do better, then fine. But I'm just saying don't feel like, well, we're not sure if we're going to be contenders yet, if we really should sell. We'll wait until, you know, the third week of July. No. Put the feelers out. Let everybody know that it's time and then make the right deal.
I agree with that.
That's that. That's just the way I see it. So Corey Kluber finished the month 4-0, 1-2-6, a complete game shutout, 6 starts, 64 strikeouts, 43 innings, opponents hitting just 150 off him, an absolutely phenomenal performance. It'll be very interesting to see the opposite of that tonight when you see a couple of guys with plus 6 ERAs. Going at it at Comerica.
Yeah, it was great pitching from both. I mean, I kind of feel bad for Michael Fulmer. Couldn't get the complete game himself.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. You know, that kind of thing happens. Look at Clevinger, like you said, you know, had a great performance, wasted. It's just the way that those things go. Okay, a couple of other notes, NBA style, because then we're going to bounce around a little bit because it is a free-for-all Friday. And if you want to get in, as I mentioned, 866-240-1065. The Warriors are being broken up already. Done. All right, that's an exaggeration. But Andre Iguodala, who has been a key piece of what they've done, remember he was, for whatever reason, the MVP of the finals 3 years ago. Andre Iguodala is not planning to meet with the Golden State Warriors during the initial free agency period. He is looking to move on elsewhere. And while he might not be part of the core, he might not be part of the core four, he's been a key part of what they do. He's been a pain in the A for the Cavaliers, I mean. In these finals for the last three seasons, they can start talking to teams at 12:01 tonight. No deals can be signed until July 7th, but the period starts, and conversations can begin starting tonight at 12:01, and he's not going to talk to the Warriors. I'm kind of curious to see what other teams he is going to talk to and exactly what kind of money he thinks he's worth at this stage of his career. Iguodala was, again, the 2015 Finals MVP. He has started just one game in the last three seasons. He's a bench guy. He's averaging 7.4 points and 3.7 points in 26 minutes a game. He was a finalist for the NBA's Sixth Man of the Year, and he's 33 years old. He's got some value, but how much value for somebody like this, and how much of a hole does it create for the Warriors roster, if any at all, if he leaves? Because we've all seen they did so much damage, the Warriors did, to the Cavaliers in the NBA Finals off the bench. The Cavaliers starters were, you know, hanging around a lot of the time, especially in those first two games. But when, what was it, 35-6 or something stupid?
Yeah.
That the Warriors outscored the Cavaliers off the bench, I think, in game two. And Iguodala is a big, big part of that. He, of course, has been a great scorer in his career, going all the way back to his time with Philadelphia with Allen Iverson while Iverson was leading that team. So, you know, he's not as young as springtime anymore, but he played some very valuable minutes and, again, won the MVP. What kind of a market do you think there is?
I think there's a decent market for Iguodala, and I think there will be. And this is obviously at his stage in his career, his last chance to get really paid, because even though, you know, the way the NBA and CBA and stuff works, you know, you can go over caps and things like that to re-sign your own players. That's why, you know, it'll hurt Dan Gilbert's wallet, but that's why the Cavs, for example, should try to re-sign, despite his finals failure, Kyle Korver, even if it's at $6-7 million or something, because they have that ability. The problem is the Warriors are about to start entering what the Cavs have already been in. You know, because now you rework Steph Curry's contract. We've talked about, you know, Kevin Durant, and just acquiring Kevin Durant in the, you know, last offseason forced them to actually get rid of some of that bench depth. This is just the inevitable happening, because when you have those kind of stars that will eventually be making those types of contracts, it's going to leave you much less flexible, and therefore there should be a few other teams out there who can offer a decent final contract to Iguodala, for example, who has some value still left.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Sorry about that. Yeah, I think that's a good point, and I'm kind of curious about the hole that it would create for the defending champions. Again, you know, he's not part of the core four, but he's a big part of what they do, and how do they fill that? You know, they filled the loss, for example, of Bogut with Zaza Pachulia, and I think that was a bit of a step back. You can't take too many steps back with these ancillary pieces and parts to your big four and just say, well, we're great enough with the core guys that we can pretty much put anybody in there. He fit the role. He liked the role, given his current state. You know, remember, this guy used to be an 18, 19-point-a-game scorer, career high of 19.9 in 2007, 2008. 18.2 the year before that, 18.8 after that, 17.1. He knows that's not him now, and he's perfectly happy coming off the bench playing 20, 25 minutes and scoring 7, 8 points a game and playing great defense. So it's not easy to replace a guy like that. And, you know, while everybody else strives to get better to catch the Warriors, it just heartens me a little bit to hear that the Warriors might be getting a little bit worse. And that's if they lose a guy like Iguodala, without value to other teams and who is not interested in talking to his current team in the first round of free agency in the open discussion period.
So, and do you buy into something that I've heard as well, which is for some teams and some ways of doing it, one of the best ways to help yourselves against the Warriors is to take people away from the Warriors, and Iguodala is the prime candidate for that.
Absolutely. And if I'm the Rockets or the Spurs or somebody else trying to chase in the Western Conference and he's available and I've got the cap space,
I'm absolutely calling him.
Make him a solid offer. I mean, you're not going to get him cheap. But you know, I mean, he's not going to be a max player. He's not going to be a, you know, $15 million a year player, I don't think. You know, but he could be a $10, $12 million a year player. You know, again, at age 33, playing 20 minutes and averaging 7 points, he could very well be. And it might have to bump that up a little bit just to make sure he is willing to leave the champions and not defend his championship. Let me get a quick call in here from Brett, who's in Perrysburg on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. Brett's wanting to talk about the Andre Iguodala and NBA free agency period that starts tonight at 12:01 a.m. Hey, Brett, go ahead.
Yeah, I just think Iguodala, he has pretty fresh legs for a 33-year-old. He's in great shape. If you think about the free agency and the contracts that are out there right now, if you think about a player like Joakim Noah, makes almost $20 million a year, I mean, there's plenty of money out there for Iguodala. He can go anywhere he wants, in my opinion.
I do not disagree with that at all. He is, yes, for a 33-year-old guy, he does look like he has fresh legs. We saw him, you know, again, chasing around some of the Cavs' best players, including LeBron, in the finals the last couple of years. And you know, he still looks spry enough. He doesn't shoot the ball like he used to. And, of course, on that team, he doesn't have to. On another team, he might be able to score a little bit more and get back into double digits and do that sort of thing. So, yeah, I agree. And when you talk about money, last year was a little bit of an outlier, as you know, because of the expanded cap at that time, and that's what allowed the Lakers to be stupid and give Mozgov 60-some-odd million dollars, which, of course, they had to dump out of there in that deal, which they did earlier this year, and some other guys got just crazy money that they didn't deserve. So it's not quite like last year. Or Noah, as you point out, that's another really bad contract that the Knicks gave to a guy who can't even play anymore. So Iguodala, who can play, yes, I agree with you. I think this is a guy who he could go to a lot of different places.
And he's the Warriors' primary defender in the fourth quarter. When they play deep into contests and into close games, he's always been the one who defended LeBron James. He's the one who defended, you know, Kawhi Leonard initially in those games throughout the season.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He's a very good defender, and he is, again, a very capable passer and offensive player as well. So, yeah, I'm excited about the fact that he's looking elsewhere. I'm not saying, I know where he's going to go, but the fact that the story we have in front of us now is that he will not meet with the Golden State Warriors in the initial free agency period means he's open to better deals. And they know, by the way, his agent knows that Steph Curry is going to be up soon, and they're going to have to pay him a max deal. They're going to pay a little bit less than a max deal for Kevin Durant because Durant is willing to do that. But when you've got the kind of stars they do, and they're going to have to pay big to keep Klay Thompson happy too very soon,
right?
They may not have enough money for Iguodala, and that's why Iguodala's like, hey, it's been great winning championships with y'all, but if there's a better market for me out there, I'm going to pursue it, and I think that's good, quite frankly, for the rest of the NBA.
Well, it makes you wonder, you know, have they told he's taken the minimum for the last couple of years? Did they tell him, hey, don't worry, we'll take care of you here, and you know, in this, you know, 2017. And then, you know, next thing you know, Durant's there, and there just isn't any money for him.
That's a fair, very fair question. That's a very fair question. And maybe he, you know, things were not going to play out the way he had been told they were going to play out, and that's why he's willing to look elsewhere. So,
and I'm sure we'll hear more soon.
I do, yeah. And I do think, by the way, if he starts talking to some other teams and places he feels comfortable with, and they give him a really nice, healthy offer, he will probably give the Warriors the right of first refusal to say, hey, if you can match that, I'll stay and we'll continue to try to win championships. And let's just hope that it's too rich for the Warriors to do, given those other needs that they have for their dollars. Like I said, and it weakens them just enough for other teams to have a shot at knocking off the champs.
He's basically taken the opposite route from what you typically see in the NBA. You know, they chase the rings. Well, he's got the rings. He's going to chase the money.
Chase the money now. That's
good for him.
That's exactly right. Well said. Good stuff. Hey, thanks for the call, Brett. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Going to get a timeout here. Bottom of the hour, Sports Center. I mentioned we're going to talk a lot of boxing, and that's going to be at 4:05. And I'm very much looking forward to the conversation with Bronco McCart on the Robert Easter Jr. fight tonight at Huntington Center. But we're also going to talk, maybe not as a talk topic, but you realize how fast the Marathon Classic is approaching? It's July 17th through the 23rd at Highland Meadows, as it is every summer and was last summer. And here's what I got for you. I got a four-pack of any-day ground passes to the Classic for any day that you choose at Highland Meadows, July 17th to the 23rd. We will give those to caller number 8. How does that sound? A four-pack of all-day ground passes, all-day any-day ground passes to the Marathon Classic at Highland Meadows. Be caller number 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, as we come right back on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Back indeed as we roll onward. It's 3:41 on a Friday. It's going to be the last live show we have for, obviously, the weekend. And then coming up on Monday and Tuesday, we're going to have some different opportunities for you as we have the Independence Day weekend that so many of us are going to be celebrating. Are you traveling? Kush, do you know what I heard today about traveling?
No.
For the first time in 17 years, gas prices are going to be lower on the 4th of July than they were on New Year's Day.
No kidding.
Normally they jack those up, as you know, because so many millions of people hit the roads on Memorial Day and Independence Day. Especially if Independence Day falls near a weekend. And, you know, it's Tuesday, so it's close enough for people to do four-day weekends, right?
Right, right.
Millions and millions of people are planning to travel, and gas prices are like 47 cents lower now than they were a year ago at this particular time. First time ever lower than what they were just on, I'm sorry, not ever, in 17 years on January 1st. So if you're heading out of town, out of state, going to, to a little vacay or whatever it is around the 4th of July, which is Tuesday, you're going to save a lot of extra money. You got a lot more for the barbecue or for the, depending on where you're going, I guess, whatever it is that you're doing. The point is more for food, et cetera. That's kind of a cool thing. So if people are driving, you going anywhere, Kush?
I am actually coming up to the Cleveland area. Going to see the family. Nice. The little one's going to spend next week with grandma. they get a week. And helps me, too.
Very nice. Yeah, very good.
So, yes, I will be amongst those that will be driving this weekend. Yep.
All right. So, yeah, you'll save a bunch of money, like I said, on gas. So that's a good thing.
Okay. Excellent.
I want to shift gears. This is a very different kind of a topic, by the way. And since it is Free for All Friday, anything you want to talk about is fine. If you want to talk about Tim Tebow, by the way, I have not mentioned it. I absolutely love the Tim Tebow story. You know he got promoted from low A ball to high A, St. Lucie, Port St. Lucie, Florida.
Right.
And everybody said why. He was only at 222. He led the team in strikeouts. This is nothing but a publicity stunt. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I love the story that in the doubleheader, the first doubleheader that he played in, he had 3 hits on the day, 3 for 5 in the doubleheader, including a home run and an RBI single. He is just, he has a flair for the dramatic. in the same way that he did in football. He did not have great stats. He did not do a lot of really great things. But when the moment was needed, he produced, like the overtime touchdown he threw to beat the Steelers in the playoff game in his last year in Denver. He just has a flair. When everybody is just bagging on him and ripping on him and counting him down and out, Tebow finds a way to come through. And I just think it's all kind of cool that while everybody ripped him, his first day with High A Port St. Lucie, after being promoted Sunday from Columbia, he homers in the second game of the doubleheader, 3 hits overall at First Data Field. He launched a towering ball just left of the batter's eye in center field on a 92-mile-an-hour pitch from hard-throwing Palm Beach Cardinals right-hander Junior Fernandez. Center fielder Blake Drake raced back to try to leap and catch the drive, but the ball disappeared in front of the pitch clock. His second hit of the day, fourth homer this year. By the way, which SB Nation was very quick to point out, Tim Tebow has now passed Michael Jordan in career home runs in minor league baseball.
Oh, my God, that's true. I didn't even think of that, but that is so true. That's the one thing among many in his baseball thing that he couldn't do. Michael Jordan had no power. I forgot about that.
He had 3 home runs, did Mike, with a big long swing of his. Tebow has a much more compact swing and much more power if you just look at his upper body and, you know, the batting practice home run displays that he has put on, which kind of got him the opportunity here. You know, he's never going to make the major leagues, obviously. He probably will never make double A. But he's in high A, and he's having a little bit of success. And we know that that success is going to be followed by a bunch of failure because a lot of the A pitchers are going to see him, figure out where the holes in his swing are, and pitch to those. But you know what? While he's doing it, I just freaking love the story. He had 3 home runs and 214 bats in low A. And although he homered twice in his first 3 games there, he had just 1 more over the last 61 games. But he rose to the moment here, and he has always said the same thing, which I love. I refuse to live my life asking what if. And that means if I never tried this when I'm 50 years old, I would have said what if. What if I had given it a shot? What if I had what it took and the skills that I had as a high school player came back and I was able to do some things? What if? He was not going to live his life that way. So he's going to struggle, and he's going to probably fail miserably very soon, and some people are going to mock him because of that, and I'm going to say, kudos, Mr. Tebow, we are not worthy. That is just outstanding, and I hope he touches some people along the way through his ministry, through his ever-going and so contagious faith that he practices. I really, really, truly hope that this thing works for a longer period of time.
Yeah.
We know it's not going to end well, but I hope it lasts longer than some people want it to, Jim.
Yeah, and I don't think it's solely a publicity thing about
no,
him
not.
Being
for,
called
for,
up.
For the club it is.
Right,
for the
yeah,
club
because you're going to get
the
extra
well
no matter
for
what.
The Nets. They're selling a lot more tickets
sure.
and merchandise at their low A and single
right.
A, and even at spring training, if you remember this year,
yep.
too, you know, at those levels. For them, it may just be a publicity stunt. He's not just doing this for publicity. He's like I said, he believes in pursuing every opportunity that he has been given with his talents to the fullest of his ability so that he doesn't have to one day look back and say, I wish I would have tried something that I had an opportunity to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't think it's any kind of publicity or anything like that. And let me put it to you this way. Earlier in the week when I got word that he was getting promoted, and I believe this is the right clip. Pedro Gomez, one of the ESPN baseball analysts, was talking about it, and I kind of agree with kind of what he's saying. It's not necessarily a publicity. It's more of, you know, sometimes if you see a guy who's struggling and they promote him anyway and you scratch your head thinking, well, why is that? It's kind of on the grounds of maybe they find something that they weren't seeing, that maybe a different level or different pitchers or something like that could break it down. I believe this is queued up, right? Let me make sure. This will be Pedro Gomez talking about this from the other day.
Let's not forget that sometimes what clubs will do is they'll promote a guy even though he may not be worthy of it, and they'll even promote him another time just in case. Like, let's say Tebow somehow gets moved to double A at some point. It's not necessarily, these scouts tell me, because he's earned it. It's more about these clubs saying, okay, look, he struggled at this level. Let's see if somehow we're missing something, and if we move him up and maybe against better competition, he shows us something. It's almost like they want to cross off their marks on their possibilities of this player to be sure that they're not missing something and that they can then say, okay, we can release a guy and not have to worry that we missed something. So the Mets might also be doing that right now.
Jim?
Yeah, that's, I kind of agree with that sentiment. I think that's what's going on here more than any kind of publicity kind of thing. I think what Pedro Gomez said is partly what's going on because
it
you
makes
know,
a lot
be
of
fair,
sense
you
to
take
let
the
different
name
eyes yeah. see him, different hitting coach. Different instructors, mm-hmm. different men, different baseball men see different things.
Exactly.
When you look at a guy, and that's a great point that you won't necessarily bump him up because he's earned it, but let's have somebody else see him and see
right.
if there's something that that we can improve upon and make him better than what he looked.
Exactly, and I think great that's point. Kind of what's going on here, and I think that, you know, that's more than fair. I mean, for what it's worth, statistically – no, it wasn't all that great of a line. You mentioned, among other things, leading the team, you know, in strikeouts. That's obviously not a good stat to have. But what Pedro Gomez has said there is, I think, kind of what's going on here.
Yeah, I think that's very, very fair to say. And again, I wish him the best of luck in the world. I want to do one other quick one here. And again, this is because coming up at 4:05, this has to be quick because we're going to talk a little boxing with the big championship fight, the great event, the card. At Huntington Center tonight with some Toledo fighters, including Robert Easter Jr. fighting for his IBF lightweight championship in the main event of the fight. So we're going to talk to Bronco McCart about that. But David Briggs, our friend with the Blade, Jimmy, I reached out to David. I couldn't get him to come on the air. I don't mean couldn't get him to do it like he refused. I just couldn't reach him in time to get him on the air.
Right, right.
And I wanted to have a conversation with him about the column that he wrote it's actually about a week and a half old now, but I just found it yesterday. So I reached out to David, and he's talking about the Confederate battle flag. In the northern pole of NASCAR, the emblem of the Old South remains risen at Michigan's International Speedway. Here in the tent city of merchandise vendors, funnel cakes, and deep-fried Twinkies on private land across the street and from the track, there atop a handful of RVs on the infield scattered everywhere. 2 years after NASCAR asked fans to stop flying Confederate flags, a symbol of heritage to some, hate to many others, I was curious to see during the weekend if anything had changed. Turns out things have. The flags are better than ever, said 69-year-old vendor Jim Taylor from Charlotte. If you can't get it, you want it. It's just like liquor during the Prohibition, Taylor said. He said he had sold some 24 Confederate battle flags leading into Sunday's Firekeepers Casino 400. Nearby, another traveling vendor said he expected to sell about 10 of them, noting that they sell at a similar rate in the north as they do at the southern tracks. Same with Drunk Lives Matter shirts in the pattern of the Black Lives Matter symbol. The flags picked up after the ban, said Jennifer Sugg, 34, of Birmingham. Now it's back to normal. Bring the normal NASCAR, or I'm sorry, back to normal NASCAR hoped was in the past. At a time when it is trying to grow and diversify its fading business, an African-American rookie driver, Darrell Wallace Jr., is a rising star. It was clear here that some roots in a southern sport tracing its origin to the days of moonshine, runners are harder to excavate than others. It was one thing for NASCAR to banish the flag from its tracks, for star Dale Earnhardt Jr. to say, I think it's offensive to an entire race, it belongs in the history books, and that's about it. It's another thing for all of them to come down. While MIS joined Michigan International Speedway, joined the call asking fans to leave their flags at home, a spokesman Sunday said the track stance remains. I asked one holdout on turn two of the infield what he would say if a Speedway employee asked him to take his down. The stars and bars and stars and stripes flew side by side high atop his buddy's RV, and Jamie Bryant laughed and said, I'd tell them to kiss my A. You get the idea. Now, this isn't to judge motivations or cast the scene here as a redoubt of bigotry. Far from it, David Briggs writes. Notwithstanding the reports from unaffiliated vendors, I would have said that the presence of the flag felt diminished. I spotted a few inside the track, and one at every campground spread over the endless acres outside, several dozen in all, but I guess here is the American and Canadian flags, or I'm sorry, the guess here is that Canadian and American flags outnumbered Confederate flags 100-1. Earlier this month, Wallace said, the only flag I see is green, white, and checkered. That makes sense. But it takes just one flag at an event to lend the sport a less than welcoming and inclusive feel. Personally, this corner sides with Earnhardt at the flag, a jarring symbol of racism and oppression. You don't have to agree. For many in the South, this is why I wanted to have Briggsy on, because he's very fair and even-handed about this. He gave his opinion, but respects every other's. Everyone else's. You don't have to agree. For many in the South and for some in the North, perhaps it represents nostalgia, ancestry, sovereignty, and just plain sticking it to authority. I've learned a long time ago to never assume anything about anyone.
people buy the flag here to prove a point, Sugg said. They don't want their rights taken away. It's part of American history. It's not a racial thing. But it is to others, and that should be plenty enough to keep the flag in storage, David writes. At the least, the headstrong few here surely recognize the pain it causes. According to a CNN poll, 72% of African Americans view the flag, now all but vanished from the public sphere, as an emblem of racism. Flying it for all to see does nothing but divide. As sensibilities evolve, the controversy evoked the removal of, in May of New Orleans, last enduring Confederate monuments. We can debate the merits of vanquishing history, but imagery matters. New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu imagined viewing one of the statues through the eyes of an African-American fifth grader. Can you look into that young girl's eyes and convince her that Robert E. Lee is there to encourage her? Do you think she will feel inspired and hopeful by that story? Do the monuments help her see a future with limitless potential? Have you ever thought that if her potential is limited, yours and mine are too? Does a Confederate relic achieve anything to move racing forward? North or South, it is time once and for all to leave the flag behind. So that's Briggsy in David Briggs at the Toledo Blade about a week and a half ago. June 19th is when that one ran. And I wanted to talk to him about it today, only because I just read it yesterday, which is to my, you know, my mistake. I didn't get it earlier, but it's okay. Because the conversation is one that's going to go on pretty much forever. Because the flag is not going to go away pretty much forever. And it says here in this corner, the one that I operate in, that it shouldn't. And there's a simple reason why. And David alluded to it when he said you don't have to agree. It is all about rights. It is all about rights. People have a right, sadly enough, people have a right to display things that hurt other people's feelings. They just do. At a sporting event or anywhere else, they have a right. Colin Kaepernick has a right to not look at the American flag, forget about the Confederate one, in the same way that everybody else does. He has a right to do it. Other people have a right to condemn him for doing it. That is what makes this country what it is. The fact that some people can fly that flag on their RV and that they can sell them at the vendors' little stands and tables at Michigan International Speedway or out at the Norwalk Speedway or anywhere else. People can sell those things and display those things because of the freedom that the American flag represents. To me, the only problem I have, the only line in David's article that I would really have a problem with, because he was very fair in his presentation, as I mentioned, which is why I wanted to talk to him. The only problem that I have is the line in which he said, some people do take offense to it, and that's why it should be removed. That's not America. That is not American sports or anywhere else. The fact of the matter is, we don't get to live our lives unoffended. That's just not the way it is. Free speech and free expression exist not to protect speech that everybody likes and agrees with. Because if that's what it was for, we wouldn't need the amendment to the Constitution, would we? We wouldn't need that in the Bill of Rights. That's not what it's about. If everybody was just flying flags that everybody liked, we wouldn't need it. If everybody had signs, if everybody had speeches that everybody liked and nobody was ever offended, then we wouldn't have a need for this. The reason for the First Amendment, the reason that flag needs to continue to be available, I'm not saying anybody should fly it. I'm not saying anybody should display it. I'm not saying anybody should sell it. But the reason that the freedom to do those things, to display it, buy it, sell it, fly it, is because of what the American flag represents. And that's the bottom line here. There are a number of things that I promise you that are flying in cities right now that offend a lot of other people, whether they be flags or banners or statements that a lot of people disagree with. And nobody is going to say, take that down because I don't like it. It hurts my feelings. It offends my sensibilities. I can't explain it to my child, whatever it might be. We don't have the right in this country to go up to those people and say, take that down. They have the right to fly something that is offensive, just as we have the right to say, that's terrible. And one shall not trample the other. That's the bottom line. David writes, it's part of American history. It's not a racial thing. And he's quoting one of the people in his column. And then David writes in his own words, but it is a racial thing to others, and that should be plenty enough to keep it, the flag in storage. I'm going to disagree. And I can tell you this. I've talked to a lot of African-Americans who say the same thing. It is a symbol of American history. It's a symbol of the wrong side of American history because they fought on the wrong side in the Civil War. And thank God they lost. But it is a part of American history. And everybody who flies it might not have any idea in their mind about race. It just might be this represents the South in the same way the Dukes of Hazzard had that battle flag on the hood of the General Lee. And they entertained millions of people in the 70s and early 80s by jumping in that thing and making a fool out of the Southern mayor or whatever he was, Boss Hogg. It's just, hey, this is the South, not we hate blacks. We support slavery. That's not what it's about for so many. So to me, and I'm not a racing guy anyway. I'm not going to the speedways anytime soon, so I'm not going to have conversations about it. But to me, just since David wrote about it, I want to respect, say thank you to him, and I offer all of my respect to him for the great way in which he presented this this discussion about whether or not the Confederate flag should be at NASCAR or any smaller races anywhere. But I would say this, if we say you can't fly that one because it might offend some people, then it's only going to be a very short matter of time before somebody says, well, now we can't fly that one either. Then we have a fight on our hands, which ones are acceptable and which ones are not. And my friends, that fight has already been had. And the winner was freedom. And that's the freedom to fly them all. And that's where I'll leave it. All right, hour number two is coming up right here. Congratulations to Eric Klasky of Maumee, who won the marathon tickets to go see the Marathon Classic on any day that he chooses. We have plenty more of those tickets to give away. We'll probably do another one in this hour and then all next week as well for the Marathon Classic. But coming up after the top of the hour, Sports Center, it's going to be fight time. Not officially, fight time is tonight. Great card at the Huntington Center, highlighted by the main event, IBF Lightweight Championship fight, Robert Easter Jr., Dennis Shafikov. We're going to talk to Bronco McCart about that showdown and some of the other fights on the card tonight. And, yes, a couple of other boxing issues, Gennady Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez, as well as the Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor circus act, and whether or not that's going to be worth watching. So we'll talk to Bronco coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Breaking ball pulled down the line of fair ball. It's by Napoli. Encarnacion scores. Here comes Ramirez into second base with a two-run double as Lonnie Chisenhall. And the Indians have taken command of the game with a three-run sixth. They lead it 5-1. Got him looking. Corey Kluber starts it off with his 94th strikeout of the year. Fastball inside corner, rung him up. That's that two-seamer. The 2-2. Got him looking. A dirty dozen for Corey Kluber.
Tremendous. You know, only thing he gave was an 0-2 breaking ball to a really good hitter. We've seen him before when he gets on a roll, and man, he seems like he's right there now. And it's good because, you know, he wanted to get to a point where he could pitch every 5 days. Giving him the ball is on a night when you're trying to stay away from Cody and Miller, and he does that. That's really big.
Driven toward the gap in left center field. That ball is hit well, and it is gone. A three-run shot for Justin Upton, and the Tigers jump out to a 3-0 lead.
Man, go to work.
Hensler just launched one. It's out to the wall, and Gordon leaps. It's gone. Home run for Ian Kinsler. And he skies this one in the air to right field. That ball is hit well. It's going to the track, to the wall. It is gone. Romine pulling one into the seats and right. And the Tigers have their third home run of the day. Looks at strike three. A good way to start this one for Fulmer. Just the 1-2. Got him strike three.
Offense did their job. Defense their job. Did their job. Obviously, Alex did his. Just went out short, you know. So, it happens. I felt like stuff was good all game. And then even that ninth inning, get two quick outs. And I wasn't trying to overdo anything. I felt like they fouled off some great pitches and ultimately got some, just found holes that one inning. I'm so happy with the way we got the win today. And just glad everybody got to contribute as well.
Shapovalov is a tough opponent. You know, he's coming to fight. But as you see, I'm coming to, like I said, put my skills on the line to be the first to stop it. Just be me. If you ever see me fight, you've seen I always stay composed and stay fighting in my rhythm. Knocking him out. Just knocking him out. That's what I'm looking forward to.
It is fight night in Toledo, Ohio at the Huntington Center, and it's something we have been waiting for.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth. But you gotta be willing to take the hits. And not pointing fingers saying you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that.
That's what I'm talking about. I tell you what, it still gives me chills every time I hear that speech and every time I hear this music. Yes, that is fantasy. Yes, that is Hollywood. Yes, that is the movies. But nothing gets me in the mood for a good fight quite like that speech. Robert Easter Jr. is in the mood for a good fight tonight, and he better be. IBF Lightweight Championship on the line. The main event tonight in Toledo at Huntington Center against Denis Shapovalov. And it is going to be something fun to see. We gave away tickets for this really all month long, and so if you are on your way to that fight tonight, you're going to have an outstanding time. Thanks so much for joining us for hour number two as we get going here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. And we welcome our resident boxing expert, the pride of Monroe, Michigan, Bronco McCart, joining us, former champion himself. He is normally a frequent guest on Mike Miller on Drive Time. Whenever they're talking fighting, he's been kind enough to lend his talents and his insight to us this afternoon here on the Extravaganza. Bronco, thanks for the time, man. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I couldn't be better, man. I'm loving the fight tonight. I'm loving the resurgence of boxing to a limited degree. I want to talk to you about that. I want to talk to you not just about the card and about the Robert Easter Jr. main event, but I want to talk to you about the state of boxing. A lot of people have watched it slip and kind of think it's been in decline in recent years with the proliferation of the UFC. But, man, there is a huge fight a little bit later on this summer. Toward the beginning of fall, and I'm talking about the Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez fight. I cannot wait to talk about all of those things. So thanks very much for being with us, Bronco. And let's start with that main event tonight and Robert Easter Jr., who is undefeated, 19-0 without any draws as well. He is the champion. He's fighting Denis Shapovalov. And tell us what kind of a matchup this is for the champ.
Well, it should be an exciting fight. They're both busy fighters, action-packed fighters, and throw a lot of punches. So the crowd's going to get a lot of excitement out of it. But Robert Easter has about a 5 to 6 inch, 7 inch height and reach advantage over this guy. If he plays it smart, stays on the outside, uses that long range jab, sets with that big right hand, I believe he can make it an easy night for himself. But, Robert has that heart of a lion sometimes, and he likes to get in there and fight when it's not even necessary. But I'd like to see him stand on the outside and box and make it an easy night and just keep that belt.
You know, that is such an interesting thing that you say, that the heart of a lion, the heart of a champion, sometimes is the enemy of a strategic fighter. So you're saying he can sometimes put himself, even though he's undefeated, he can put himself in danger that he doesn't have to if he's got that, that reach and, the tail of the tape is so heavily in his favor.
Absolutely, 100%. And I guess one of the classic fighters that's known for that would be a guy like Tommy Hearn, who could have boxed very easily on the outside most of his fights. But, man, when the bell rang, he came to get you. And sometimes he put himself in positions that wasn't necessary. And I watched Robert Easter, of course, because I watched him grow up, and I know his dad really well. We're good friends. So I followed his career, and sometimes I watch his fights, and I think, man, he gets in the brawls that aren't necessary when he could just stay on the outside, use that long, because he's very athletic. He's very skilled. He's got a beautiful jab. He's got beautiful boxing ability and good power, too. So why not use all that to your advantage and not get inside and take some of that away?
That's a great comparison, by the way, to the Hitman. And, of course, we all remember the three-round war, maybe the most violent three rounds in the history of boxing with Hagler. And he never had to do that, but he was determined that if Hagler's coming for him, bring it, man. I'm coming right back for you.
Right. I mean, I love guys like that. Don't get me wrong. I'd rather see a man go out on the shield. But then again, this is a sport of, a real true boxing purist knows, just like Floyd Mayweather says, everybody else is playing checkers. I'm playing chess. You know, he uses the beauty of boxing, the beauty of defense, you know, the beauty of mind games. He uses it all. So, you know, Robert Easter could be a guy that could stay around for a long time and dominate if he uses his tools to his advantage.
You had 68 professional bouts yourself. You won 56 of them with 34 knockouts, lost 11. You had one draw. Did you learn this from your time in the ring, what you're talking about now, about how to kind of resist the urge to go in there and slug with somebody with that heart of a champion, as you say, and the desire for the knockout that must exist in every fighter, that killer instinct? Did you learn to suppress that and fight with the skills that you needed against a given opponent, or did your trainers, or did you learn that from someone else?
Actually, I learned it by a hand injury. I mean, I was the guy that I liked to go in there and bang and get on the inside and bang. And I was 6 foot tall as a junior middleweight, which is a good height for my weight class. And I could have boxed easier on the outside and done things like that. But I got a hand injury, and I had to learn to rely on my boxing more. And I got that hand injury probably around 30 fights in. So I actually, for over half of my career, I fought with hands that just weren't good. So I had to box more than bang. But I did. I liked it sometimes. You know, when you're a fighter, at heart, you're a fighter. So you get hit with, you like.
Hey, Bronco, your voice is fading out on us. I don't know if the phone moved or what, but if we can try to get that back again, because I don't want to miss what you're saying. Try that again.
Okay. Said about halfway through my career, I had a hand injury.
I heard that part. That was good. It was just the tail end of what you were saying there about how you kind of had to become more of a boxer. But yet, after that, you said about half your career, you kind of had to really box more than slug, but yet you still managed to win 34 of your 56 by knockout.
Yeah, it was, I just methodically broke guys down. You know what I mean? I got a lot of my knockouts later because I trained hard, I worked out hard, and then I just pinpointed my shot. You know, I didn't just throw crazy shots and get in these fights. I tried to box and be smart and land, my shots accurately and just break guys down.
Yeah, I'm looking at your record right now, and your last five victories of your professional career were all by TKO. Exactly what you said, breaking guys down. You couldn't, because of the hands, you know, throw maybe that one knockout blow, but you could sure as heck, you know, combination your way into ending fights.
Exactly, and all that matters is a win is a win, no matter how you get it. But everybody knows that boxing, just like baseball, everybody likes the home runs, everybody likes the knockout. But
that's
the fighters, they like the wins, but you want to put fans in the seats, and they like excitement, and Robert Easter's style brings excitement, but sometimes I think it puts me on the edge of my seat personally.
I'm looking, we're talking to Bronco McCard about the big card tonight. We'll get into some of the other fights too, but one more thought on Easter and Chafikov, who is, of course, the main event. 5'11 to 5'5. I mean, you talked about the height and the reach. According to the tail of the tape, I'm looking at 76-inch reach to 68.5. That's pretty, is that uncommon, or how, maybe a better way to ask it is, how uncommon is that for the lightweight division? I mean, we're talking a major difference in height here.
Yeah, that's very uncommon. But again, Robert Easter is very tall for that division. You don't see guys hardly maybe 5'7", 5'8", in that division at the max. You hardly see guys 5'11", 6 foot tall in that weight class. And he has a great, great reach advantage. And like I say, I would like to see him use it more. But, you know, they both had very good close fights with Comey, I believe how you pronounce his last name. They both had good close fights with him. So styles do make fights. That doesn't mean that this fight will be close, but I'm expecting to see an action-packed fight while it lasts if it doesn't go the distance.
Tell me about the experience factor in this fight, Bronco. Robert Easter Jr. is 26. Shafikov is 32. So there's six more years Shafikov has been at it. And he's had obviously a lot more fights as well. He is 38-2 with 20 knockouts. Robert Easter exactly 19-0. So twice as many fights for Shafikov. Is that an issue for Robert Easter? Does Shafikov, you think, with all of that experience, know how to play chess, as you talked about?
Not necessarily, because Robert Easter is coming in as the world champion, and he's coming in off of his first world title defense. So when you're good enough to become a world champion, what happens is, once you win that world championship, your mental game goes way up. You're already physically capable, obviously, of becoming a world champion. You're that good. But once you win that belt physically, then mentally you go to a whole other level. You believe that you can't be beat. And plus he's young, and you got that youth behind you. And, you know, youth can be dangerous sometimes. Because you believe as a youth that you can do anything and nothing can stop you, and you know, and so I think that I think Easter has the advantages going in myself personally.
I love interviewing fighters. So many great insights that you can get from somebody like Bronco McCard, who joins us this afternoon on the Extravaganza. Bob France with you, along with Bronco. And Jim Krishlin is with us here, too. And Jim's got some questions for you about the rest of this card. You may go ahead.
Yeah, and when I look at some of the rest of this card, Bronco, the thing that jumps out at me is coming back to something I've learned now in my time here in Toledo about a little over a decade, and that this is a really, really good boxing town. It really is, for those who don't know, and I know you're fully aware of this. Some of the other cards in the fight, for example, one of the welterweight bouts later tonight, Scott Grannon, undefeated boxer, Wesley Tucker's going to be in there. You have another Toledoan in a super middleweight bout. I'm seeing a couple other Ohio guys. So really, this is kind of I wouldn't say a homecoming, because, you know, we're here in Toledo at Huntington Center for this. But once again, to me, not just the Robert Easter part, because he's a Toledoan, of course, too. But I'm loving how up and down the card, it's either Toledoans or Ohioans all over the place. And it's once again, at least to me, reminding everybody that, hey, Toledo, really good boxing town, in case you didn't know.
Yeah, they really have made quite the resurgence back into boxing. And then with Robert Easter winning the world championship, and then you got a couple young guys in your city right now that I believe are ranked in the top 10, top 15 in the world too. It won't be too long before they get world title shots. And you've got good young and up-and-comers, and it's really great for the city of Toledo personally, and for the state of Ohio, and just for boxing in general, because these, you know, the first few fights are going to be broadcast on Bounce TV, and I'm actually out of state right now. I'm in Virginia Beach, but I'll be watching that on TV tonight myself. So it's really good for Ohio. And then the Huntington, you know, that last fight, Easter sold it out, and I'm pretty sure tonight will be sold out too, and it was just a crazy crowd, and the people loved it. And I remember that night when I was leaving, somebody asked me, do you think they'll have fights here again? I said, are you kidding me? I said, with the crowd that they had, the money they generated, they'll be back soon. So here we are a couple months later, we're going to do it again.
Bronco McCard is our guest, talking about the big fight card tonight at Huntington Center. Robert Easter defending his championship. That is, of course, the headliner. You were known as Superman during your time in the ring. 68 career bouts, as I mentioned. Won a few championship belts yourself. Can I ask you this? What makes a guy, you know, I mean, we watch the movies, and even sometimes real life stories, you know, a 30 for 30 where they really go inside, and little, you know, documentaries and bios on guys who broke into the fight game. And a lot of times you see and hear the story about fighters who come from terrible, terrible backgrounds are the best fighters. That's because they fight, because it's all they've got. They feel like there's no way out with school. They feel like there's no way to get out of their poverty or whatever it is, and the only thing they can do is to fight their way out and make a living with their hands and getting punched in the head. And that may be the case for a lot of guys. What was your background? What made you decide, you know what I want to do with my career, what I want to do for my life, is I want to trade blows trying to knock somebody else unconscious while they try to knock me unconscious for prize money? What made you say that's me?
Well, you know, I came up with a family of fighters. My dad and all my uncles, every single one of them competed and won in the Toledo Golden Gloves, actually. But I was that kid, I mean, I came from the broken home and all that, but my home life wasn't bad. I had a good home life, had a good father, good mother. But the thing is, I got to the age when I was about 13, 14 where I fell in with the wrong crowd. And I was getting ready to go down that path. You know, I didn't fully go down the path because my dad caught wind of what was going on, and he had a good idea. And when I came home from school one day, he just sat me down on the couch and said, listen, I'm going to step in right now. I'm going to make a change in your life. You can do what you want every single day when you get home from school.
but it's going to be with me. If you want to go fishing, I'm going to sit next to you and fish. If you want to play basketball, I'm going to sit on the sideline and watch you play basketball. But whatever you want to do, you're going to do it every day. And he was training boxers at the time himself, and I said, well, I'll start going to the boxing gym, just test it out, see what I like. And I went down there one day and was sparring this guy that was like a tough guy in our neighborhood, and I hit him with a right hook, and he went down, and I kind of thought, wow, man, I just knocked the guy down. That's crazy. And then I was hooked.
That's an amazing story, and of course the lineage helps that story along, as you said, coming from a family of fighters. What about for kids who don't? What about kids, you know, maybe whose dads say something similar? By the way, that's a cool story that your father said, I'm going to make a change in your life. I'm not going to let you run around with the wrong crowd. You're going to be with me every day. That's, I mean, God bless your dad.
Absolutely.
But not everybody has that, obviously, and they find their way into a boxing gym for the first time in another way. How do you find out this is for you? And what I mean by that is there was an old, and I don't think it was Mike Tyson, but it might have been Mike Tyson or somebody who said, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the mouth.
Oh, that's Mike Tyson.
Was it Tyson? He said, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. Then everything is off. All bets are off. And, you know, young guy might think, I want to do that because, as you just said, I just knocked that guy down. And that's the easy part. But it's taking one and not getting knocked down. It's like, holy hell. That hurt. Where am I? My eyes are watering. My nose is hurting. Everything is stinging. I'm a little bit dizzy. What the hell just happened? How do you know that you can take that punch? You know what I mean? And realize that I can take many of those and still have my plan, even though I just got busted in the mouth.
Well, there's a couple ways of looking at it. I mean, like, when we were getting ready as amateurs, I remember, for the Toledo Golden Gloves, we would usually start training around January because the gloves took place around March or April. And the gym would be full in January. Everybody wanted to box. Everybody, then come February and March, it thinned down, and it was about the same five guys every year. Because once guys got hit and realized that you are going to get hit in this sport, some guys, they're just not made for that.
Right.
But when you've gone through things like I said, my mom and dad got divorced, and when that happened to me personally, it made me very angry. And when I would go into the boxing gym and I would box and I would get hit, I used to think to myself, this feels nothing like the pain I felt when my mom and dad got divorced, and I'm going to make this guy pay for this, you know, and I would just use my anger, and fortunately a guy like me took my anger and I bended it in the right direction, where a lot of young guys or girls, whoever, but we're going to say men here right now, when they go through things in their life and they get very angry and they go out and they do it in the wrong way and they focus their energy in the wrong direction, you know, they end up in jail and prison and things like that. Fortunately, I had a dad who could see that I was going down that path, that I was a very angry young man, and that I needed something to vent it out, and boxing was perfect for me.
How do you, Bronco McCarter's, I guess, we're talking fighting, all things fighting. Obviously, we're talking because of the card tonight and the Robert Easter Jr. Fight as he defends his IBF lightweight championship. I love talking to fighters. I've heard some fighters say that anger is your enemy when you're in the ring. You're just telling me that's what drove you, my anger about my personal life, my home life, my family, and it's just, and you had to take it out on somebody, and then, as you say, when you got hit, it was nothing like the pain you were really feeling inside because of your home life, and this is where you vented. A guy like Floyd Mayweather, who's, you know, arguably pound for pound the greatest, maybe still today, Lord knows, but certainly one of the greatest of all time, doesn't look like he fights angry. He looks like he fights like he's an accountant. He's calm and he's cool and he's just kind of like, you know, sizing things up and just fights a very methodical, intelligent fight, one in which he avoids getting those shots to the head, and he just racks up points and wins. So what's the difference between an angry fighter who succeeds and an angry fighter whose anger gets the best of him? Kind of like what you said about Robert at the beginning of our conversation. You know, he might know that he's got to stay on the outside and just, you know, rack up points and win this fight, but if he gets angry and goes in there and tries to bang, he could put himself in danger. So is anger always good if you're a fighter?
Well, I mean, now we're talking a different kind of anger. When they say you can't fight angry, that means you can get in there and get hit with a shot, and then all of a sudden lose your composure and go out there and try to get it back right away and try to attack out of anger because you're mad because you got hit. What I'm saying is I channeled the anger in my personal life, and I brought that hurt and that anger and that pain with me inside the ring, and I used that as my outlet, and it helped me and made me successful. Mike Tyson, when you watched him fight, that was a guy that looked like, to me, he fought angry.
Oh, yeah.
He came to rip his head off, you know. So not everybody
is the same. Like Floyd Mayweather, he's poetry in motion. Sugar Ray Leonard, he didn't look like he fought angry either, Sugar Ray Leonard had an extremely mean streak in him.
Oh, he was vicious.
He's
my favorite fighter ever. Sugar Ray's my guy. People think he was just a dancer. Sugar Ray was vicious. I mean, he got in there with Tommy Hearns, who should have knocked him out six ways from Sundays in 1981, and took him apart on the inside. Same thing, obviously the shocking fight with Hagler, but the Duran fights, the Benitez fight to start it off, that was a guy who I'm going to look pretty, I'm going to dance, I'm going to do my thing here, and I'm going to, put on a show. But my gosh, he got nasty and knew when to get angry, did he not?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You fight with a controlled anger. You don't lose your composure, you don't lose your control, and you just go, you don't fight crazy because you got hit with a punch. Sugar Ray Leonard fought with controlled anger. Every great fighter fights with controlled anger. Nobody loses their composure and stays great. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, no question about it. And, we're talking with Bronco McCart about just about all kinds of boxing. Since we brought up Floyd, so many boxing purists are livid that he is going to kind of come out of his semi-two-year retirement, if you will, and have this little thing with Conor McGregor. Where do you come down on this? Is there a problem with a guy who's only been an amateur boxer? He's been a professional UFC, a mixed martial arts fighter, but he was an amateur boxer for a while. You have a problem with a guy like that having a fight with one of the greatest pound-for-pound guys ever and currently undefeated, a guy like Floyd?
Well, I'm gonna try to give you two different opinions on this.
All right.
If Floyd Mayweather was, let's say, if it was Mike Tyson, if it was Mike Tyson in his prime and was fighting an MMA guy that was crossing over, I would say, man, this guy's going to get murdered. It's ridiculous that they're even going to allow this to go on. They're going to watch a live murder on TV and people are going to pay for it. But in a case like Floyd Mayweather, who's not a big puncher by no means, he's a precise puncher. He can knock people out, but he's not going to just mutilate somebody like a guy like Mike Tyson would in his prime. So here you got McGregor stepping over to fight Floyd Mayweather. It's going to be a terrible fight. I mean, I think if Floyd stops him, it's just going to be an accumulation of punches later on. He's not going to just walk out and dominate this guy. I don't think. It could happen, but that's just not his style.
I'm just predicting a 12-round unanimous decision, literally. Probably. All 12 rounds, 120 to 108 is what I think is going to happen, because Floyd isn't going to be silly enough to put his jaw anywhere near where McGregor might hit it really, really hard, because that's his only chance. And McGregor, of course, is never going to be able to hit Floyd hard enough because he's the best defensive fighter of his generation and maybe of all time. So I don't think there's anything close to resembling hard punches here that are going to happen, and it's going to be Floyd just doing his thing and winning every round 10-9, and away we go, 120, 108. That's my prediction.
And the people are going to buy into it. It might be one of the big pay-per-views of all time in the history of boxing. And if Floyd gets the fight, Floyd wins the fight, if he loses, it'd be crazy. But when he wins the fight and he's 50-0, I don't see in the record books them being able to count that as a 50th win. I mean, it is, but it's going to have an asterisk next to it, kind of like the home runs when Barry Bonds and those guys were hitting him on steroids or whatever.
Yeah.
You have to have an asterisk next to it because it's not a real win over a world-class boxer. The guy's world-class in his sport. He's the best in what he does over there in the MMA. But that's apples and oranges. Nothing is the same.
Yeah,
and
who was Floyd's first win over? Do you know?
His first win ever?
Yes. You don't know?
No,
I don't know. But my point to that is, it wasn't a world-class boxer, and it counts among the 49. So who cares if it's the first one or the last one? If it's a sanctioned bout, do we really, and I'm not a huge Floyd fan here, but I'm just trying to be real and trying to defend the guy in this regard. Would it really need an asterisk? It's a sanction, and McGregor is probably as qualified for this fight as the first guy Floyd ever beat, who was probably some tomato can someplace, 15 years ago.
Well, I can tell you this. I sit on the Boxing Commission for the state of Michigan. I approve. I'm on a subcommittee to approve the fights that take place in Michigan.
Okay.
I can promise you right now, never would a 49-0 guy fight an 0-0 guy anywhere in the United States of America, except it's going to happen in Vegas because of the money that it's going to generate. It's just like Barnum and Bailey, when they hung a sign up, come see the egress, and everybody ran through the door, and all that is exit in another language. You know, it's just people are getting sold something that's not real. I mean, a 15-0, 20-0 guy couldn't fight a guy making his pro debut on any boxing commission in the world. But the fact, I have to say this too, this is where I have to go back, because James Toney crossed over in the MMA and fought Randy Couture, who's one of the all-time great Hall of Fame fighters in the MMA, and that was sanctioned too, and James Toney never had an MMA sanctioned fight. The bottom line is, I guess why it's being sanctioned and why it's allowed to happen is because they're both fighters.
Right.
It's just in a different type of fighting, but they're both fighters, but still, I mean, you're talking the best of our era for sure against a guy that's never put on a pair of professional boxing gloves in his life. You know, it'll count as a win, but everybody's going to say, you know, everybody that knows boxing is just going to say that's just a...
Do you think he'll need to, Bronco, talking about Floyd, will he need to have at least another one against a legitimate fighter to wrap his career rather than have this one be his last? Because that would be the last taste people have, is that circus, that farce, that joke, that money-making event between him and McGregor. Do you think he'll have to go one more against somebody tough?
No, I don't think Floyd would have fought again if it wasn't McGregor. Just because McGregor was chasing Floyd because he knows that's where the money is. I mean, that's like walking into the store and being told what the lottery is going to be and just buying the ticket. You hit, you know you're going to hit, it's worth it, right? So him chasing Floyd, and they're going to make hundreds of millions of dollars apiece. I'd come out of retirement and fight anybody for $100 million. You kidding me? I mean, you can't even be mad at those two guys. They're the two smartest out of everybody involved in the whole circus.
Well, there's no doubt. Because neither one of them are going to get hurt. They're both going to get paid all of that money. And I'm going to buy it, by the way. I don't know if I'll buy it myself and pay the whole full freight. It'll be $100, whatever it's going to be. But I'll go in with somebody and do this thing. Because even though I know what the outcome will be, and I'm telling you, I would put a mortgage payment or two if I gambled, which I don't, on what I said being a 12-round unanimous decision for Floyd without McGregor winning a single round. But neither one of them are going to get hurt. So, yeah, they're smart. They're going to get all their money without getting hurt. But just because they are in a ring, you know, if Floyd slips on some sweat when trying to juke one of McGregor's wild punches and it hits him, that's why you watch. It's why you don't watch a race to see the wreck, but you know there's always the chance for the wreck. And that's what keeps your eyes glued, to see cars flipping over 16 times in midair. And that's why people are going to say, you know what, we know what's going to happen. But what happens if somebody jukes when they should have jived and there's a car in the ring flipping over 15 times in the air?
I just can't see, like, you know, McGregor, I can't, even if he landed, Floyd Mayweather takes a great shot, too. Let's clarify that, because remember when Shane Mosley hit him with two of the hardest right hands I've ever seen land flush on a person? That if Shane Mosley had hit anybody else in that weight class, would have been out. Floyd Mayweather took him. He buckled. He didn't go down, though. Took those shots and came back and dominated the fight. Conor McGregor is not a big puncher. I don't know where, I mean, he might be an all right puncher with 4-ounce fingerless gloves in an MMA cage. They're wearing 10-ounce gloves in this fight. I'm telling you right now, he could hit Floyd with his best shot, and he's not going to knock him out.
It's a great point. I brought this up, too, when talking about Conor McGregor's knockout potential here, because he is a hard hitter in the MMA. But, A, it's the 4-ounce gloves. But as you know, in the MMA, if you knock somebody to the ground with your right hand, you get to jump on top of him and keep pounding him until he can't defend himself anymore, and they wave it off. If he was to somehow slip and catch Floyd in a scenario like I described, you know, and it would be like, you know, us finding aliens tomorrow, because that's about the likelihood that it's going to happen. But if he did, he wouldn't be able to jump on top of him and finish him off. He'd have to get away and let the guy regain his senses. And that's the difference, you know, between the two sports.
Absolutely.
So Bronco, one other one I got to ask you about before you go, and I really appreciate your time. We didn't expect to have you on this long, so you're being a great sport. I appreciate that.
No problem. No problem at all. Appreciate it.
Canelo and Triple G, Gennady Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez, is the one a lot of people have been waiting for a long time. It's coming up in September. Boy, I'll tell you what, you've heard probably Oscar really, really complaining about the Mayweather fight, because it's going to steal some of the thunder from this one, which should be the fight of the year. It should be the, you know, the pay-per-view event of the year and one of the biggest ones, you know, in recent memory. What do you see when you look at this matchup between these two tremendous champion fighters?
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I've been excited for this fight to happen. Here's my quick breakdown of this fight. I think that Canelo Alvarez has what it takes to beat Triple G. I just don't know if Canelo believes it, because Canelo seems to me has been finding excuses not to fight Triple G, but now the fight is finally going to happen. So, now, styles make fights. There's things that both of these guys do that could, play out interesting in the fight. But here's what I say. If there's a game changer in the fight, a game changer punch, it's going to be Canelo's uppercut because of the way that Triple G sometimes defenses up. He leaves himself wide open for uppercuts. And Kell Brook caught him with a couple good uppercuts when they fought. And he was a welterweight, and it looked to me like he buckled him the one time when he hit him. And I think Canelo has enough that he might be able to beat Triple G. That's my opinion of that.
Well, that's a great analysis, and you're right about styles making fights, but you didn't give me a prediction. You just said he might have enough to do it. Are you saying that he will do it, or is this Triple G's fight?
Oh, man.
You know, it's funny. I know it's still a couple of months away. It's in September. But I'm making you make the call here at the end of June. What are you going to call?
Okay. All right. So me and my girlfriend were having this discussion this morning. She says, I'm not even a better.
Hold on. You found a girl that loves fighting? You found a girl that's a fight fan, and you are a fighter and a promoter, and what did you say? You hold you sit on the board in
the boxing commission.
Michigan, the commission,
yeah.
And you found a girl who's a fight fan. God bless you, man. You
found
a jackpot.
She's starting to become one. She knows a couple guys that she really follows. She knows it pretty well. But
it'll be the day that I ever say the words. Yeah, I was talking to my wife this morning about this fight, and here's what we think.
Yeah, well, she said to me. She said, I want to bet on this fight. She said, I'm taking Triple G. I said, okay. I said, if I have to pick a fighter, I said, I say it's a 50-50 fight, but I'm going to have to bet on Canelo. I'm going with Canelo. I just have a feeling.
I think what you said is very true. You know, he's been looking for reasons to not have this fight, and does he really believe he can do it? And while styles make fights, you know, attitude going in makes fights, and I think Golovkin has been just waiting for this opportunity. For those who don't know, Gennady Golovkin is 37-0 with 33 knockouts. He is 35 years old, though. Canelo is 49-1-1 with 34 KOs. He's only 26. Golovkin is the more experienced fighter in terms of age, but not in terms of number of fights, and he is the one who has wanted this, and Canelo has not. I'm no fight expert like you are, Bronco, but Doesn't the fact that you started out with this saying, you know, he tried to avoid this fight, doesn't that give Gennady Golovkin the advantage?
It definitely gives him, in my opinion, the psychological advantage. But it could have been one of those deals like Floyd drug out the Pacquiao fight for so long that when people finally got it, man, they jumped all over it and they spent a ton of money and them guys made hundreds of millions of dollars. It could have been a mental ploy. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know, but I'm just going to. Just off styles, after watching the last few fights of both of these guys, and I've studied them close because I just had a feeling they're going to do something soon. I'm leaning towards Canelo. I'm leaning that way.
I like it. Yeah. I'll tell you what, man. I've really enjoyed the comp. By the way, Robert Easter tonight. Decision, or do you think he gets a knockout at TKO?
Ooh, man. I think he gets a stoppage. I think he stops him late. Robert Easter stops him late. Yeah.
Stops him late. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you said like you were going to pick a round. Stops him late. Gotcha. I'll tell you what. I really enjoyed the conversation, Bronco. I would love to have you back on sometime in the first or second week of September, right before that actual fight. We'll get a little bit more in-depth on why you're picking Canelo Alvarez. Can we do that?
Absolutely. Sounds great.
Great stuff. Thank you, sir. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Bronco McCart joining us, the pride of Monroe, Superman. 56-11 in his professional career. He wants some belts as well, and he's got a great analysis there of not only tonight's Robert Easter Jr. Championship fight, but also the Gennady Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez fight. Okay, if you're a fight fan, you had to enjoy that. That was fun. That was probably the best interview I've done, not because of me, but, I mean, my favorite interview and conversation in months. I really, really enjoy that kind of conversation. All right, let me get a quick time out here. Now it's not the bottom of the hour anymore, but we're going to call it a sports center anyway. And, Jimmy, what do you say we give away another pair of tickets a four-pack of Any Day Ground Passes.
Sounds good.
To the Marathon Classic at Highland Meadows. Coming back are the Lady Golfers July 17th to the 23rd. And I got that four-pack for Caller 5 this time. Caller 5 at 866-240-1065. And we're right back after this.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I'll tell you what, that's one of my favorite interviews. Whenever I get to talk to a great fight guy, whether it be a former fighter like this or a trainer, a promoter, those kinds of people are almost always my favorite. I'm such a big boxing fan from back in the day, and I've been such a I've been so disappointed with the, you know, the plight of the sport, I guess, in the last 15 years, maybe the last 10 years. And it's not just MMA that people are turning to. It's just that the promoters, you know, it's like we talked, Jim Bronco and I talked about the Pacquiao fight with Mayweather. The promoters haggle and fight over percentage of purses for so long that the best fights don't get made until sometimes they're far past their prime, which, of course, Matt Pacquiao and Mayweather were when they had that fight 2 years ago now. And I feel like that's what's hurting it. Back when I loved the sport as a youngster, as a young guy, in the 70s and in the 80s, as I've talked many times about the glorious golden era in which everybody fought everybody, and if somebody won, somebody said, you got a rematch, let's do this. And I'm talking about, you know, Leonard and Hearns and Hagler and Benitez and Pryor and Arguello and Livingstone, Bramble and Mancini and all of those guys in the 70s and 80s. And, of course, the big boys at the top of the world, the top of the division, when it was Ali and Foreman and Frazier and Norton and Holmes later than that, and even Spinks. And everybody fought everybody. There weren't competing promotions. I mean, there were, but everybody was willing to make these fights because they knew there was, you know, this is what the fight fans wanted to see. And those things just aren't the way things are anymore. And it just makes me sad because I get getting really, really excited for September 16th. The Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez fight. Triple G and Canelo Alvarez is going to be a flat-out freaking war. You know, it reminds... You know, I shouldn't say that it's been that too, you know, that far back either. Going into, you know, the mid to late 90s and maybe even the early part of the 2000s, that's why I kind of retracted my last 15 years to maybe the last 10. You know, you had a lot of great fights between the likes of Sugar Shane Mosley, as he just talked about, between, you know, the likes of Sugar Shane and De La Hoya and Camacho, and although that was a little bit earlier, who else? Sweet Pea, Pernell Whitaker. The fight game was still so strong because the best fighters fought each other, and you didn't have as much of the competing promotions holding it up the way you do anymore. It just makes me sad. I'm so excited for this fight, but I've been excited for this fight for a lot longer than I should have had to wait for it. You know what I mean?
No, I kind of do. I kind of do. And though I'm not, you know, I'm not as big a boxing fan personally, but I do appreciate it, and I certainly appreciate, respect, and acknowledge, you know, its history through the decades. But you're hitting on something right there. It's more about haggling over the price. And that's taking up more center stage, especially once you get, regardless of the weight class, once you get to the top of the mountains where say, a Floyd Mayweather has been, obviously.
Yeah.
And even I know, when I was real young in the 80s and stuff, even I knew that wasn't the case at that point in time or before, but it's become that way, you know, a little bit now. And that's part of the sad part about it. And you're right. Too often... And I'm a little guilty of this too, Bob. Too often, we attribute boxing's issues to, well, it's the rise of the MMA and the UFC and stuff. Oh, and there's no big time, you know, American at the top of the heavyweight class. And that's while true, both of those things, that simplifies it more than it is.
Yeah,
it's more complex
yeah.
than that.
That's a big part of it, though. It really is. The heavyweight division has always been where the, you know, the attention goes to first. If you were the heavyweight champion in the world, you were what Mike Tyson used to call the baddest man on the planet.
Yep.
Because the best big guy is always going to beat the best little guy, which means the welterweight champion is a champion among that size guys.
Right.
But you ain't a champion compared to this guy. The heavyweight championship always carried with it that extra little, I don't know, that cachet, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's not the case anymore. But like I said, the other part of it is the promoters. For example, though, the reason why, you know, the MMA or MMA in general and the UFC in particular has grown as fast as it has is because a guy like Dana White says, the fans want to see you and you. Guess what? You're fighting. We'll see you in a month. And then the best fighters fight each other. And if it's great, they'll do it again as soon as somebody's done rehabbing from the friggin' career-threatening injuries that one of them suffered from having their arm broken in an arm bar. But that's the point, though. They make those fights. You don't have to wait for them. Here comes UFC 294. And guess what? You know, the two best fighters at that weight class that you've been clamoring to see are going to go. And it's much more controlled. Some say the fighters don't have as much freedom as they should have because of that. But you know what? The fact is the sport itself, it might not be as good for the individual fighter who's got his own promoter negotiating kind of like a football player does with his own agent, with the owner. But the sport itself is better off for it. And that's one of the reasons, one of the problems I have with the way boxing is run now. But damn, I enjoyed that interview with Bronco McCarty. Okay, that's it. All the time we have. I knew we'd have a short one here, and indeed we did. Listen, we have got a long Independence Day weekend in front of us, a four-dayer. So thanks so much for being a part of it. We'll talk to you next live on Wednesday on July the 5th after America's birthday. So celebrate it in grand style. Celebrate the liberty that comes along with it, and we'll see you on Wednesday. Have a great one. Bye-bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.